content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is John Ivey from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the August 2019 issue of Sports Illustrated for Kids. We're going to begin on page 8 with our last line of Who's Who in Sports. We're going to start with Tim Anderson, shortstop of the Chicago White Sox. His height is 6'1", his weight is 185 pounds. He was born June 23, 1993, in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Through June 20th, Anderson had 15 stolen bases, fourth best in the American League, and was batting .312 with 10 home runs and 32 RBIs. He was named the American League Player of the Month for April after hitting .375 with 5 doubles, 6 home runs, 18 RBIs, and 10 stolen bases. He also had 2 4-hit games. Anderson, who did not play baseball until his junior year at Hillcrest High in Tuscaloosa, led the basketball team to the Alabama 6A title as a senior. Question: who was the most recent White Sox player to earn American League MVP? Answer: Frank the Big Hurt Thomas. He did this in 1993 and 1994. Next, we have Philip Lindsay, running back, the Denver Broncos. His height is 5'8", his weight is 190 pounds. He was born July 24, 1994, in Denver, Colorado. Lindsay was named to the Pro Bowl and the All-Rookie team after rushing for 1,037 yards, ninth in the NFL, and 9 touchdowns in 2018. Last season, he became the first undrafted free agent in league history to gain 100 or more yards in each of his first 2 games. He left the University of Colorado as the school's career leader in all-purpose yards, 5,760, and was the first player in program history to have back-to-back 1,000-yard rushing seasons. Question: who led the NFL in rushing in 2018? Answer: Cowboys running back Ezekiel Elliott. And finally, Trey Wood, skateboarder, Dutour. His height is 6 feet. His weight is 120 pounds. He was born September 6, 2000, in Queen Creek, Arizona. Wood won his first X Game gold medal in Shanghai, China, in June, finishing first in the big air event. He landed a trick that had never been done in competition, a body varial 720. His board made 2 360-degree revolutions, while his body did a 540-degree spin. He previously won Big Air Bronze at 2018 Games events in Sydney, Australia, and Minneapolis, Minnesota. In 2012, when he was only 11, he finished 15th at X Games Los Angeles. Question: when was the first X Games held? Answer: 1995. It was called the Extreme Games for the first year. Not always your favorite team. Here are some players who were on teams but may not have been their favorites growing up. We have Paris Saint-Germain forward for the Kylian Mbappe. Paris Saint-Germain forward Kylian Mbappe loves Les Bleus. The French national team was my favorite because it's the team of my country. I like Zinedine Zidane a lot, like every young guy in France, and Thierry Henry. They won the World Cup in 1998, and it was the first time in history. It was a great moment for all France. All of my room was for the French national team. I had posters, a lot of balls, a lot of T-shirts, too. Tampa Bay Rays pitcher Blake Snell supported the Seattle Mariners. The Mariners were my favorite team growing up because I was from Seattle, and my dad and I watched Alex Rodriguez and Ken Griffey Jr. and that whole team. I only went to 3 or 4 games, but my dad and I watched Monday through Thursday every night and 50-50 on the weekends. I didn't care about pitchers. I think pitchers are cool, but you see position players every day. I fell in love with Griffey and Edgar Martinez. That's how I fell in love with the game. I didn't like facing former Mariner Ichiro when I played him in the majors. He's one of my idols, so I didn't want to face him. It was really weird. I've been collecting memorabilia the last couple of years. I have a lot of Griffey stuff, A-Rod stuff. I have a Hank Aaron jersey. I'm getting into it as I'm meeting them and understanding who they are. L.A. Sparks forward Nika Agwamike, rooted for the Rockets. My earliest memories of being a Houston Rockets fan always involved a jam-packed room with my family cheering at the TV screen. Most times, watching the games together involved my sisters and me wearing T-shirts from the one or two Rockets games we were able to attend at the Toyota Center that season. A Rockets home game meant a home game in the Agwemeke house, meaning we cheered loudest for T-Mac, Tracy McGrady, near left, and Yao Ming, far left, excited that we got to stay up past our bedtime to experience a Houston win. Texans are proud, but Houstonians are even prouder, which is clear from the way we support our teams. No matter how the season was going, we rocked our red and showed out for the Houston Rockets. Sabre center Jack Eichel backed the Boston Bruins. My first memory as a fan was on my 4th birthday when I got tickets to the Bruins versus Maple Leafs game. I got into a competition at the game for the naming of the Bruins mascot, Left. I remember my name idea for him was Smokey the Bruin, but he was eventually named Blades. I was crushed as the Bruins lost in overtime. As a kid, my walls were covered with posters. I was more into players than any specific team. Whoever the guy was at the time, I had to have their poster. My number one favorite player was Pavel Bure. He had his own wall in my room. Actress Kristen Bell digs the Detroit Red Wings. The voice of Anna in the movie Frozen belongs to someone who grew up obsessed with a team that played on ice. Bell's Red Wings won the 1997 and 1998 Stanley Cup Finals, and she was featured on a playoff ticket when she was 19 and went by Annie. Her middle name is Ann. Hockey was the only thing in high school no one cared about Brad Pitt or Tom Cruise, she said on a radio show in 2017, referring to the 90s heartthrobs. I had posters of right wing Darren McCarty and goaltender Chris Osgood on my wall. They were all gods to me. Superhero Bowl. At the end of starring Chris Evans and Chris Pratt. At the end of Super Bowl 50-49, Patriots quarterback Malcolm Butler made a last-minute interception of Seahawks quarterback Russell Wilson, as famous as spoiler alert from Iron Man's on Thanos at the end of Endgame. Like Tony Stark's ultimate sacrifice, Butler's snag was bittersweet, at least for one Avenger. Evans and Pratt had made a bet. If Evans Patriots won, Pratt would don his Star-Lord costume and visit Christopher's Haven, which provides outpatient housing for kids with cancer in Boston. If Pratt Seahawks won, Captain America would bring his shield to Seattle's Children's Hospital. Like true superheroes, they visited both places together. Rap star Drake roots for the Raptors. It's been a pretty great year to Aubrey Graham, the Canadian musical artist better known as Drake. He won his fourth Grammy Award in February, then watched from his sweet courtside seat in Toronto as his hometown Raptors won their first NBA title. He got some major airtime, talking trash with opponents and giving a coach a shoulder rub. And of course, after the win, he dropped two new tracks. Former President Barack Obama cheers for the Chi Sox. In 2009, the 44th President of the United States was asked to throw out the first pitch at the All-Star Game in St. Louis. Instead of playing to the crowd and wearing a Cardinals jersey, Obama wore a Chicago White Sox jacket. He's such a big supporter of the team that he often starts sentences with, "As a White Sox fan," He did make one small concession welcoming his team's crosstown rivals to the White House after their World Series win. Among Sox fans, he said that day, "I'm the Cubs' number one fan." Total fandemonium continues. Posting up. There is no better personal expression of a young fan than his or her bedroom. We asked to see your coolest fan-centric rooms, and North Carolina-based Bears fan Levi Widener came through with an awesome football fan headquarters. We see all of the pictures and posters that this young man has on his wall, along with some great shirts. Game changer. With New York down 4-3 in the eighth inning of Game 1 of the 1996 American League Championship Series, Derek Jeter lofted a ball toward the Yankee Stadium right field fence. Orioles outfielder Tony Tarasco had just enough room to make the catch, but in stepped 12-year-old Yanks fan Jeffrey Meyer above, who had played hooky from school that day. He reached over the fence with his glove and tipped the ball into the stands. Umps awarded the home run to Jeter, and New York went on to win. Mayer's glove sold for $22,705 at an auction in 2015. Not bad. Through rain and sleet and snow and ice, fans of soccer team Lok Vladivostok in Russia are used to cold. The average temperature in January is in the single digits. However, a big snowstorm in November 2016 took everyone by surprise. The club needed all the help it could get to clear the field and asked the fans. An estimated 50 supporters came out, including some supporters of the visiting football club Cuban Krasnodar squad, who had traveled more than 4,300 miles to see the game. Now that's dedication. The NFL's Packers and Bills have experienced similarly snowy situations. In 2017, both asked fans to clear the stands of snow, offering hourly wages as well as free tickets. Tricks of the trade. We're still on page 35. Trading cards have changed quite a bit since the editors of this magazine were kids. These days, leagues grant companies exclusive licenses. Before that, multiple manufacturers flooded the market with different lines. You could own hundreds of cards just of your favorite player. The more cards change, though, the more they stay the same, colorful rectangles. Here's how to start a collection that will stand the test of time. Number one, figure out what you like. Don't get caught up in the hype of how much a card is supposedly worth. If you just like the Orlando Magic, focus on getting those players. Or if you're a slugger and only like similar pros, give those pitchers to your kid sibling. Number two, don't expect to get rich. There will never be another T2006 Honus Wagner on the right. The ultra-rare baseball card from the early 20th century that has sold for over $3 million at auction. Modern cards should be viewed more as fun collectibles than investments. And finally, three, collect with a friend. Buying singles is a good strategy to filling out a set, but it's fun to open packs, especially if you have buddies who are willing to trade. We're on to page 36 and 37. Top 10 fan bases. Borussia Dortmund. Soccer is the ultimate fan sport, and Borussia Dortmund draws some of the biggest crowds in Europe. The Gelb Wand, the yellow wall, is an iconic brick of 25,000 fans who pack in to signal Iduna Park's massive standing room only South Terrace. With flags flying and chants raining down, the yellow wall sets the tone as the most intimidating section on the earth. Number two, Henshin Tigers. The baseball lovers of Nishomaya, Japan, are loyal, loud, and coordinated. The cheering section, or Wondonan, lead the crowd in chants the whole game. 95-year-old Henshin Koshin Stadium stays packed despite a tidal drought. The fans blame themselves for cursing the team after throwing a statue of KFC founder Colonel Sanders into the Donbori River while celebrating their last championship in 1985. It's a long story. Number three, Winnipeg Jets. Economics forced the original Jets to move to Arizona in 1996. When it was announced in 2011 that the Atlanta Thrashers would move to Winnipeg, the NHL's smallest city, to become the new Jets, all 13,000 season tickets were purchased in just 17 minutes. Notorious for its playoff whiteouts and hostile chants, Bell MTS Place makes opponents feel snowed under. Number four, Newcastle United Football Club. Like the other fans toward the top of this list, Newcastle supporters, known as Geordies, make a small market seem big. A recent survey of neutral attendees by Football Ground Map showed that St. James Park has the best atmosphere in the Premier League, a contention few rivals would even challenge. Number five, Buffalo Bills. Losing four Super Bowls in a row would have crushed a lesser fan base. The Bills Mafia loves to team this team so much they donated $415,000 to Andy Dalton's foundation in 2017 when the Bengals quarterback's Hail Mary touchdown against the Ravens sent the Bills to the playoffs for the first time in 17 years. Number six, Football Club Barcelona. This list definitely favors the passionate small town fans who exceed expectations. But at some point, we had to give up to the sheer size of the FC Barcelona fan base. Over 100 million Messi maniacs who like Barca on Facebook can't be wrong. Number seven, Nebraska football. The Cornhuskers went 4-8 last season, but their faithful still made the top 10 in the NCAA in home attendance. Their 2000 invasion of South Bend when number one Nebraska played number 23 Notre Dame made an Irish home game look and sound like Memorial Stadium. Plus, the Husker fans have a reputation as some of the nicest around. Number eight, Duke basketball. Everyone loves to hate the Blue Devils, and their fans deserve partial credit for that. The Cameron Crazies who occupy the student section at Duke basketball games have a reputation for being clever maniacs, always looking for new ways to mess with the opposing team. And Krzyzewskiville, the complex of tents that pop up on campus before a big game that is named for the team's coach, is the world's most impressive arena line. Number nine, Iceland. The supporters of Iceland's men's national soccer team are so cool, they have their own fans. Just 350,000 people live in Iceland, maybe fewer than in your hometown. So when its soccer team plays in major international competition, a tenth of the entire country leaves the island to go cheer. The Viking clap they perform with the players after games is an unrivaled tradition. Number 10, Sacramento Kings. Bad sign. The Kings have threatened to leave Sacramento so many times, the relocation attempts have their own Wikipedia page. But the crowds have showed more loyalty than the franchise itself, despite 13 years and counting without a playoff appearance. A near 500 record last season hopefully means that faith will be rewarded soon. The Legend. 5 years after capturing the nation's imagination, Monet Davis is heading to college, taking on a new sport, and showing us why the best is yet to come. Legend continues. SKOTY check-in. On an unseasonably cool afternoon in mid-June, Monet Davis walked into the student center in the Harborside campus of Hampton University in Southeast Virginia, nearly 300 miles from her home in Philadelphia. It had been almost 5 years since August 2014 when Davis's well-developed right arm grabbed the sporting world's attention. Pitching for the tiny Philadelphia Dragons in the Little League World Series, 13-year-old Monet, only the fourth American girl to ever play in the tournament, threw two shutouts, paving the Dragons' way to the semifinals. She threw a 70-mile fastball and a devastating curve. She received shout-outs from Kevin Durant, Michelle Obama, and Lil Wayne. Her precocious, composed demeanor and dazzling performance landed her on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Later that year, she was chosen as the Sports Illustrated Kids Sports Kid of the Year. She played wiffle ball with Jimmy Fallon on TV and appeared on stage on the ESPY Awards, where it was named Best Breakout Athlete. She took the mound before Game 4 of the World Series between the Royals and the Giants to throw out the first pitch. It was a strike. And she did all of that before she had started ninth grade. "It's kind of crazy," she says now, "to think that at such a young age I've been mentioned with some of the greatest people in the world." Now, with high school complete and her first day of college looming, she headed for the second floor of the student center, where a coach and two future teammates awaited to present the new spikes and uniforms Davis will be wearing for the next 4 years at her new home, playing a new sport, softball. The road that brought Davis to the Pirates' incoming class was a winding one. Back in 2014, she said basketball was her best sport, and she wanted to play at UConn. She even played a game with the Harlem Globetrotters in 2016. But a junior year ankle injury had backburnered that plan. She played varsity baseball as a freshman at Springside Chestnut Hill Academy, the private school she attended in the Philly suburbs, but then gave it up for softball because she was just wasting her time on the bench, not doing anything. As for college, she simply thought softball would be more fun. "I wanted to do something for the next 4 years, to have fun, and softball was it," Davis says. "Nowadays, sports are a little too serious. I just try to have as much fun as possible." As for what brought her to Hampton, a historically black university, Davis wanted to attend a school where she was in the majority, not the minority, after attending a largely white school since the second grade. Though she is in some ways like any teenager, she stays up all night and can sleep all day on the family couch. Her bed is covered in laundry. She just got her driver's license. She snacks questionably. Doritos dipped in cream cheese is a favorite. She has been a role model long enough to understand that her choices carry weight. "I think more people are going to start coming to HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities," she says. Davis visited Hampton's campus over homecoming weekend last October. She met with softball coach Angela Nicholson and journalism school dean B. DeVita Plummer. "This young woman was exceptional. And then I started to feel a little role reversal, like it was important for me to hear her talk about her passion," says Plummer. Her post-college dream is to host her own show, interviewing athletes around the world. Just after she left campus, she told her Snapchat followers that she would be attending the school next year. She hadn't yet told her mom. Now, with college nearly upon her, Davis roamed the campus grounds from the softball stadium to the famous Emancipation Oak, a 70-foot-tall tree that doubled as the site of the first Southern reading of President Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. She also stopped by the first classroom for newly freed men and women in 1863. "I just wanted," she says, "a place that felt like home." Now some pictures of Monet here. And then and now, Davis dominated the mound, earning her the honor of 2014 Sports Kids of the Year. And she still has her cover. Then at the top, in the middle, primetime attraction, after her star turn at the Little League World Series, Davis found herself among celebrities like Madison Bumgarner, Magic Johnson, and Jimmy Fallon. Her favorite artist is Beyonce. Her favorite athlete, Kristen Press. Favorite emoji is the Hawaiian hello. And book, Hoop Girls. Luck of the draw. Ties are often, actually they stink. Really, we could go either way on them. Here are some of the most notable even Steven contests in history. Number one, Notre Dame versus Army, November 9, 1946. 3 years ago, number one Clemson and number two Alabama played a 45-40 national title game. That's 95 more points than number one Army and number two Notre Dame managed in 1946's game of the century at Yankee Stadium. Both teams came close to scoring. Heisman-winning Army fullback Doc Blanchard got chased down on a breakaway run, and the Irish got as far as the four-yard line, but turned the ball over on down because hard-nosed coach Frank Leahy didn't believe in field goals. Seriously. Both squads finished undefeated, but Notre Dame grabbed the number one ranking. Number two, Notre Dame versus Michigan State, November 9, 1966. Score lines rarely tell the whole story, especially in the case of a tie. While its famous draw against Army in 46 was remembered as a classic, Notre Dame earned jeers for its role in a 10-10 game against Michigan State 20 years later. The matchup between undefeated top-ranked teams was also hyped as the game of the century. It ended when Notre Dame coach Errol Parseghian had his team run the ball on its final drive instead of passing in order to let the clock run out. He argued later that his team had fought hard to come back to tie the game and didn't want to risk giving it to them cheap. The Irish were again rewarded with the end-season top ranking. Number three, Bengals versus Eagles, November 16, 2008. Some people don't know that NFL games can end in ties, since it rarely happens. Among those people in 2008 was Eagles quarterback Donovan McNabb. A 10-year veteran, McNabb was ready for a second-place overtime after failing to score against the Bengals in the 15 bonus minutes. He infamously admitted not knowing the tie rule in a post-game press scorm. Go easy on him, though. While there were two ties just last season, the Eagles-Bengals 13-13 deadlock was, at the time, the first one in 6 years. And finally, number five, Hurricane Panthers, April 4, 2004. The NHL did away with ties after the 2004-2005 lockout. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Sports Illustrated for Kids. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm John Ivey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreading.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138.